going back to CERN, this grand conspiracy I was referring to make war on God and to release these entities that are bound, to open the gates and release them, is at the center of this is the desire to restore and resurrect the Golden Age. And the Golden Age is the time when the gods were with men, were among men, and mingled themselves with men. It's the narrative of Genesis 6, except for the Luciferians, the way that they view the Golden Age was a time of bliss. That's the way they view it. It was a time when the gods were among men, teaching mankind and were benevolent, and that mankind was prospering under the gods, and there wasn't war, and there wasn't famine, and there wasn't pain, and there wasn't death, by the way. That's the Golden Age to them, see? But the truth is that the Golden Age to those of us who know the truth and who read the scriptures and who understand the narrative of not only Genesis 6, but of the Book of Enoch and the Book of Giants and all the other ancient texts that refer to the true context of the Golden Age, it was not a time when you wanted to be a human being on this earth. It was a time of great destruction. It was a time of great bloodshed. It was a time of great sorcery and wanton wickedness on the earth, so much so that the earth had to be destroyed by a flood. A time of genetic corruption, monsters and demonic creatures, the likes of which we can't even properly portray in movies. I mean, it's no wonder men's hearts will fail them for looking after those things which are coming upon the earth. And because there is a resurrection, there is a re-institution that is coming of the days before the flood of Noah, the days of Noah. And that's why that terminology is so important to people like us and Steve Quayle and Tom Horn and Ellie Marsouli and everybody else who's in the field researching this stuff. Because we understand, we've had a glimpse of what the days of Noah looks like, and it ain't good. It isn't pretty. It's a darkness that we can't even comprehend yet, but it will be reinstituted. It will be resurrected before the end, before this whole thing comes to a conclusion. But we can have comfort in the knowledge of how this thing ends, which is what I referenced in the beginning. Jesus wins, period. That's the end of the story. So we're not trying to get people to be afraid. There's a difference between being afraid of something and being aware of something, because whether you like it or not, it's happening. I mean, whether you like it or not, you're drinking fluoride. Whether you like it or not, you're being affected by what they're pouring into the atmosphere through chemtrailing. Whether you believe it or not, doesn't make a difference. Whether you like it or not, cancer's up thousands of percentages from 20 years ago. Whether you like it or not, it makes no difference. It makes no difference whether you like it or not, whether you believe it or not. There is a Luciferian priesthood on this planet bent on your destruction, especially if you're a Christian, whether you like it or not. And people say, well, but we don't have to worry about that unless you live in Iraq, I guess, right? Unless you live in Syria. If you or I are a Christian living in Syria, you with your children, me with my children, do you think that the time frame of the rapture would be that important to you? I lived in Peru, so when we were thinking about where do we want to go first for our first expedition, Peru was the natural choice because it was the quickest, it was the easiest for me to put together. I have a lot of context there. I know what I'm looking for. And so that was just on a very basic level why we chose to go to Peru first. But then also it turned out to be a very wise choice because, as it happens, Peru and Bolivia are linked in a very interesting way, specifically Peru and Bolivia, to a lot of other places on Earth. And in ways that I wasn't even aware of before. So it turns out that it's a good foundation. It's a good place to start. If you want to really get a good glimpse, an introductory glimpse of what of what David Flynn refers to as Cyclopean technology. And not just David Flynn, that's actually a common term that's used for the kind of megalithic stonework that fits these stones together without mortar, these very large stones. Peru is a great place, and Bolivia, to get a hands-on experience of what it actually looks like up close, because a lot of places you can only see things from a distance. A lot of places on Earth are closed. You don't want to go anywhere in the Middle East to see this kind of stuff right now. So Peru is still a very tourist-friendly place. Bolivia, not so much, but definitely Peru. And so all the logistics worked out. I speak Spanish, so everything just kind of worked out, and we went there and for our first expedition. But what I wasn't anticipating was to discover along the way all of the historic documents that prove the existence of giants, and not just the existence of giants that are that are 9 to 12 feet tall, but the existence of giants that are 15 to 30 feet tall, that were 15 to 30 feet tall. Very precise historic records concerning giants, histories concerning giants, both from the Inca and from the conquistadors and the historians, the chroniclers that came after them. So it really, I think, a lot of people were probably bored out of their minds in parts of our documentary film, because I lay out so much. I had to decide what of this content do I want to include in the film, this historical content. And I just said, you know what, I'm just going to put it all in there. I mean, it may make your eyes bleed, you know, for about 5 minutes or so, or 10 minutes or so during the documentary, to just absorb that much textual information. But it really lays the foundation for everything else that we're doing, because I think we've established that giants did in fact exist, and not just, you know, 9 foot tall guys, but 15 to 30 foot tall entities, that they're absolutely incorporated into almost every major system of legends and myth from the primary civilizations on Earth, including the ones from South America, including the Maya, the Aztec, and especially the Inca. So we laid the groundwork, we laid the foundation that the megaliths were not built, historically speaking, in the opinion of the natives and in the opinion of the conquistadors and of the chroniclers. The megaliths were not built by the natives. The megaliths in Peru and Bolivia were not built by even some extraterrestrial entities. They were very convinced. In fact, the Inca matter-of-factly believed that the megaliths were built by the gods before the world was destroyed in the flood. That the megaliths were built by the gods and their giant offspring. That's what they believe. We're not superimposing our belief onto what they believe. We're showing you what they believed. As a matter of fact, what they believed. Again, the Inca, the conquistadors, and the chroniclers believed that the megaliths, specifically in Peru and Bolivia, because those are the ones they're referencing, were built by the civilizations that existed before the flood of Noah. Civilizations, many of which happened to be giants. And I say many of which because there was so much going on in the pre-flood world. Oh my God. I mean, it was just an absolute, the complexity of what was happening before the flood of Noah. Look at what's happening now in our technological age. But I'm telling you, it was even more complex before the flood. Different kind of technology, but even more complex. There were so many creatures roaming this earth, so many entities, sentient entities, conscious beings that were not human and that were never supposed to exist, roaming this earth before it was destroyed in the flood of Noah.